And here we are, Cinema Squabble, episode 59. Adam Gerke, Sarah Michelle Fetters, and Steve Reeder, returning squabbler. Yay. Cheers all around. Who are we? What do we do? We are a number of Seattle's film critics, and for years we've gathered in studios, and we discuss theater and film, and now we bring that discussion to you in podcast form. You can find us at cinemasquabble.com. You can also find us on iTunes and Stitcher and anywhere you get your handy podcast. And the fact that you're actually hearing us now would indicate that you have already located us. So well done. Good job on your part.
Wow. That's good way to put that, I guess.
Right?
Yeah.
See? So yeah.
Circular thinking.
If you're within the sound of my voice, you've already done a good job. Yeah. So, hey, you know, there's been a lot of films that have screened in the Seattle area, part and parcel due to the fact that we've had the Seattle International Film Festival. And, Steve, we want to pick your brain on this because you were saying your unofficial count is up to, what was that number?
111 features. That doesn't count shorts, but, 111 this year. Yeah. And out of, I should point out, 415 total films, so I only scratched the surface, but that's all you can do with the biggest and the best attended film festival in North America.
But 111 features, I mean, there's this year they were down a little bit as far as their feature length stuff was concerned. That's still like, because there were, what, 60 documentaries and just over 140 films this year, something
basically,
like that?
That's roughly the case.
Yeah,
yes.
So I mean, out of 200, roughly, to 250, you saw 111.
Yeah.
111, we should point out one of the reasons that the number of films is down is that a lot of the features got as many as three screenings because the festival continues to expand to other venues within the city and in the suburbs. And so it really is engaging in outreach to a broader audience.
Right. Interesting little change of pace, though. I noticed that this year, in years previous, for the last several years, I'd done a lot of work with the city of Renton, and they did not participate this year. But Kirkland did, and a few others did as well. So... a slight change on that whole venue, but interesting outreach.
We'll have Beth Barrett in at some point to tell us why that was the case.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm assuming it was about venues.
Possibly entirely, or who knows. We'll have to get the actual skinny from Beth on that one.
I know, right?
So speculation aside. there have been some other releases that have been out in theaters this last 2 weeks.
We suddenly exploded again because everybody is no longer afraid of the big behemoths that are coming out.
Yeah.
No more Guardians of the Galaxy, no more Wonder Woman. So now the deluge, where we suddenly have 3, 4, 5, sometimes 6 films releasing every weekend.
And I think let me cut to the chase on this real quick, because you and I both walked out of The Mummy.
Yes.
And this is a week after Wonder Woman.
Yes.
And we've realized that Wonder Woman was sort of the... That was the one that I think a lot of folks were really wondering about, and I think still continues to just be a smash at the box office.
Oh, yeah. First superhero movie, first modern superhero blockbuster to drop less than 50% in its second week.
Mm-hmm.
It only dropped 45% last week. It is going to be a monster hit.
Terrific word of mouth.
Yes.
Yeah. Terrific. Yeah.
So that being said, we walked out of The Mummy, and your reaction was, and this isn't actually indicative of the movie quite yet, but your reaction and my was, well, it's unfortunate that this is the follow-up to Wonder Woman as far as sort of franchise films go.
Yes.
Because,
So The Mummy, this new version of The Mummy, stars Tom Cruise as an Iraq War veteran and treasure hunter who gets himself... in a mess, where he finds the tomb of
He calls it an airstrike, basically. Yeah. He calls it a U.S. airstrike in an Iraqi town once formerly known as Mesopotamia.
Yes, and inadvertently uncovers the tomb of Amenet, a lost Egyptian priestess, played by the really talented Sophia Boutella, who almost makes a terrific villain.
Mm.
Almost, if the movie would have let her. But that's another story. but basically, it's a movie about Tom Cruise's character being chased by a mummy because the mummy wants to kill him and let him get possessed by the god Set, who is her lover. And so he will become the personification of death on Earth.
Yeah.
If
all powerful.
The two things that make this movie interesting. One is that it's the proposed first episode of Universal's Dark Universe, which is going to be a series of interconnected movies featuring all of their classic monster movies, all of their classic monsters, Creature from the Black Lagoon, Frankenstein and his monster, the Wolfman, the Invisible Man. All of them, Dracula. They're all supposed to, intermingle and mix and have a big, huge Avengers-style movie at some point, all with Russell Crowe as Dr. Henry Jekyll running point. Yeah. So that's
He's the master of prodigium or something like that, which is like this place where all the evil, bad things are going to be contained
and
perhaps unleashed for good purposes. Later. If we can turn evil for good, maybe.
Exactly. Yeah. The second thing, and the one that makes it so comparable to Wonder Woman, is the treatment of our female lead. Mm-hmm. Jenny Halsey, played by Annabella Wallace. Again, another very talented young actress.
Wait, did you say not a talented young actress?
I said a very talented young actress.
Okay.
She is supposed to be the second smartest person in the entire film, right behind Dr. Jekyll.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you got to go with Dr. Jekyll. But she is supposed to be the second smartest person in the entire movie. She's supposed to be with it. She's supposed to be able to take care of herself. She's supposed to do everything that anybody else in this movie can do.
Mm-hmm.
It is the most regressive female heroine that we have seen in ages. And not only is it jarring just in the wake of Wonder Woman, mm-hmm. it's jarring just in the wake of recent Tom Cruise films. I mean, you look at the Mission Impossible series, all of those movies are filled with strong women.
Mm-hmm.
Every single one of them.
Including villains.
Exactly. You know, Cruise actually has a pretty solid track record on that front of not being the stereotypical male hero who constantly saves the day for everyone else. He does. He's the hero. He obviously does save the day. But the women can do the same. This movie, she can't do anything.
Yeah. And in addition to that, he seems completely, confused in his role.
Sure.
in times where he's smart, but then he's completely confused and an idiot. And then it's just so unbalanced in its construct, his character development, her character development. The thing starts failing almost right out of the gate.
Yeah, I mean, the movie's horribly written, which is odd because you've actually got a lot of talented screenwriters that are attached to working on this, including director Alex Kurtzman, who, yes, I mean, he wrote the Star Trek and Pirates of the Caribbean movies. He's written some other stuff that's worked pretty well, especially big genre-type filmmaking. But, you know, Christopher McQuarrie, he's talented. Dylan Kuzman, he's talented. Jenny Lamette is talented. David Koepp, you know, he wrote Jurassic Park, and he's done plenty of things that are good.
Mm-hmm.
This movie is just a giant mess. And it does have the same problem in some ways that Batman versus Superman had, in that it's so stuck setting up a universe that it can't actually be its own movie.
Yeah.
Because it has to, get things ready for this bigger world, the movie itself constantly suffers. There's actually no movie here. There's no story here.
Well, there is, but it's just not interesting.
No, it's just bad.
What it comes down to.
And it's a waste of time and energy. And even the stuff where they pay homage to the 1932 version and the 1999 version with Brendan Fraser, even that stuff just falls flat.
Yeah. Did you now there have been many mummies over the years.
Yes.
Steve, do you recall any that were particularly interesting to you from maybe your childhood or anything that maybe you saw on like a Sunday morning matinee or anything like that? Or does any of the mummies reach out to you?
Absolutely. And I think this is going to figure number two on Sarah's list, because for me, I was raised on the Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee, Basil Rathbone school of Hammer and related horror. And the Lee and Cushing version of The Mummy from 1959, for me, still resonates. I did see it as a child. I did see it on the small screen initially.
Right.
And again, it's full of flavor. It's full of action. It has ideas in it. It has genuine thrills in it.
Yes.
And in a way, it was kind of an adult film for a child when I first saw it. It was very intelligently made.
Yes.
Yeah.
And very British.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's good. I'm sorry. I just watched it again. After we watched The Mummy, I actually went home and just watched it again. And it's so good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry.
So that's the what year did that one come out?
1959.
59. So
it was one of the first Hammer collaborations between Cushing and Lee.
Yeah.
I think it was. I'd have to look it up. And normally I'm better at my Hammer history. I think it's what they made right before Dracula.
Huh.
It's either right before Dracula or right after Dracula. And I mean their partnership through those Dracula films, and then also doing their Sherlock Holmes film, Hound of the Baskervilles. They did so many great Hammer productions together I mean, the list is endless.
Yeah. And it's a good case study because there was a horror universe.
Yes.
That was consistently good.
Yes.
Featured strong acting, strong supporting roles and characters, and worked. You really looked forward to every
yes.
part of that franchise without Sarah, as you noted in this most recent case with Tom Cruise and The Mummy, writing by committee, trying to tell so many stories at once that you don't tell any of them well.
Yeah.
Can't disagree with a single word there.
Couldn't agree more. Yeah.
I mean, even the bad ones are great.
Yes. Yeah.
So with this one, Sarah, skip theater, rent?
It's a total skip. Okay. I mean, it's a total complete skip.
Okay. I was actually going to come in on the rental category on that.
Of course you were.
And the reason I say this is because we are going to want to keep, I want to see I want to see where Universal takes this. I do want to see if they can make enough course corrections to keep this on track, and will they learn from their lessons in this? And so,
but will they? Do they have too much money already sunk into it that they have to keep going? Is it like the DC universe where you can't stop? Or because the next one, The Bride of Frankenstein, doesn't come out till February of 2019, mm-hmm. that they actually have time to put on the brakes and go, yeah, let's rethink this.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you think is going to happen?
I think they can save it. I think there are enough course corrections they can make here. It's kind of like with the Christopher Nolan Batman trilogy, I'll call it. The first, you're looking at me with wide eyes on that.
Yeah, because Batman Begins is legitimately great. It might be the best of the three.
Well, the first Batman of that, I thought was total bunk. I thought it was terrible.
Yeah,
I
didn't. Okay. You can sit in your little minority house on that one.
No, actually.
That is really wrong. Nobody agrees with you there.
No.
Dark Knight Rises is the only one that people have problems with.
See, and Dark Knight Rises is, on the other hand, where I think the crowning achievement of what they've got there. So we're going to agree to disagree on that. We're going to agree to disagree on that.
Hey, we had a squabble.
So, right.
And Adam just lost.
Well, he did, really. Well, thank you. Thank you, Steve.
No, because what I can say is Morgan Freeman, Katie, yeah. what's her face, whose name is completely.
Katie Holmes.
And
she's fine.
No. It's bunk. She's terrible. She can't act her way out of a paper bag in that film.
I would disagree.
And then we're seeing an ATV and we're getting completely sidetracked. Yeah. That thing is just, completely unbelievable. When we get Heath Ledger in the picture, though, that changes the tone, it changes the dynamic, and the film just actually starts
The second one is legitimately fantastic, even though the script is nowhere near as tight as it was in the one before.
See, and I would disagree.
Trust me, the second one is really easy to pick apart. It's just so well made, mm-hmm. you don't care.
See, and therein lies the issue. But where I'm going with this is I want to see how this universe is set up. I think they can make course corrections on The Mummy and the whole Dark universe. I think it can be done. And so I want to know the origins of where it's all starting. So that's why I'm saying it's a rental.
Okay. Well, there you go. So it's a rental.
Mild defense of The Mummy, even though, yes, it's not a great film. We can all agree on that. That brings us to another one, though, that's out this week. The Book of Henry, completely different.
Yeah.
So here's the gist of this. We've got Naomi Watts, who plays a woman by the name of Susan Carpenter, and she happens to be the mother of two boys, Henry Carpenter and Peter Carpenter, and that's Jaden Lieberher and Jacob Tremblay. And you are familiar with at least Jacob from Room.
Yes.
And I can't remember where we've seen Jaden
before. Midnight Special.
Yeah,
he's the kid from Midnight Special. So, he's also the kid from... St. Vincent.
Right. So Jaden,
which was on your top 10.
Yes. Henry happens to be precocious, and precocious beyond. So he's 11 turning 40, basically.
He's a genius.
Mentally. And so he is above and beyond. He's the parent in this relationship for Naomi being mom. And so Henry is helping to run the family. He's helping to keep things afloat. Meanwhile, mom is working in a diner along with Sarah Silverman. And then there happens to be Dean Norris and Maddie Ziegler. Yes, the same Maddie Ziegler of Dance Moms, who happen to be the next door neighbors.
Who gets a moment to dance in the movie, of course.
Yeah, she gets her moment in the sun. What we see is that there may be some child abuse happening next door.
That's an understatement.
Well, maybe. I'm not gonna give away all the goods in that regard. But
yeah, the trailer gives that one away.
Well, so all right, fine.
No, I'm not just, I think that's good.
So there's child abuse. and there needs to be some resolution, but forging paths forward will not be easy all around, I think is the best way to sum all of this up.
It's a good way to put it.
This film wrestles with some pretty heavy adult topics because we are dealing with child abuse, alcoholism, we're dealing with mortality,
grief.
We're dealing with grief.
Friendship, brotherhood, family.
So many things all hitting the page, and again, for the first two-thirds of this film, I really think you've got a great, it's kind of this nicely paced, endearing, I can't call it a coming-of-age story because it's not a coming-of-age story, but...
It feels a little bit like Radio Flyer or Stand By Me, mm-hmm. or even The Goonies,
yeah.
but in a movie where the context is child abuse and grief over death.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's an odd film. Mm-hmm. The people that are gonna hate it, and looking at some of the reviews out there today,
are people
there
hating
are a
this?
Lot of people that are hating.
Really?
The people that are gonna hate this movie are really gonna hate it. Hmm. And the reason for that is because director Colin Trevorrow from Jurassic World and Safety Not Guaranteed, and writer Greg Horowitz, who's mostly known for some television stuff,
mm-hmm.
They take some subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
It's very similar, if you remember Little Children from 2006.
Mm-hmm.
That movie dealt with child sex abuse, and it dealt with pedophilia, and it dealt with infidelity, and it dealt with a lot of really tough subjects. It did it in the context of an adult, searing, brutal drama.
Mm-hmm.
This movie deals with a lot of similar constructs, but in a childlike and child-friendly PG-13,
yeah.
almost Spielbergian way.
Absolutely it is. We see some punches pulled in a very Spielbergian way.
Yeah. So the knee-jerk reaction when you start having some of this stuff take place in the film
mm-hmm.
is going to be that you just can't do this. It's not allowed. If you're going to tackle this stuff, it has to be more serious. It has this can't exist in a movie of this style. I disagree.
I disagree completely as well.
I actually think the first hour of this film mm-hmm. is really good.
Yeah.
It's not until you realize that it's mostly been Naomi Watts' story and not the story of the kids, do I think things start going off the rails a little
yeah.
bit.
Yeah, it pulls it. It becomes weak sauce, I think, and the recipe just kind of gets watered down. We don't see quite the impact, ultimately, in the end, that we need to see. And it does fall apart in that regard.
I think there's just too many plot tangents mm-hmm. that you can't easily coalesce into one.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the choices that Watts' character, Susan, some of the things that she decides to do are going to be really difficult, especially for parents,
mm-hmm.
to admit that they understand.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think they do make sense, especially when she gets to her greater realization about who she is and mm-hmm. that she's taking an advice, even though he's a genius,
mm-hmm.
even though he's the smartest person anywhere,
mm-hmm.
she's taking advice from an 11-year-old.
Yeah.
And one of the things the movie, I think, does actually very well is it points out that just because you're intelligent doesn't mean you have experience.
Mm-hmm.
And especially for a child, I mean, he's been on this earth for just a little bit over a decade. You know,
yeah, that's part and parcel to, like, for example, first and second year med students, you and people diagnosing themselves mm-hmm. on the web for, oh, I got this thing on my elbow. What the heck is this thing on my elbow? The way it's been described to me is if you were trying to research your own medical condition from what you can find on the web, basically, you're about as qualified as a second year med student. When you're doing that, there is something to gaining those flight hours as a med student, and then as attending or whatever, you know, before you become like a full fledged doctor, you have to put in plenty of hours of learning. Ah, okay, this is sometimes how these symptoms appear, and sometimes it's da 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 da. So that actual gained knowledge of knowledge on job, that's one of those things. And I think parenting is the same way. You learn a lot on the job, and you know, being 11 versus being 40, that's going to be a pretty big
stretch. And at some points, I think every parent, they get lost in being a parent.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the children do run the ship.
Yeah.
And you just have to bring that back. You just have to remember, hey, wait, who is the kid and who is the adult?
Yeah.
I think that.
And let's emphasize, too, it's PG-13,
mm-hmm.
a very conscious decision made by the makers of the film. They want young people to see the story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And appreciate the story and confront these issues themselves, even if the script and the story do ultimately seem a little watered down.
Yes.
what I appreciate about this is the way the humor bounces along. It's adult humor mm-hmm. that I think a 13-year-old will easily be able to grasp and hang on to. So I think that ties it together. Plus, the performances from our two young leads.
Oh, gosh.
Wow. That in itself was impressive. So to me, this is at least, I'm going to say matinee or at least a rental. So that's where I'm coming in on this. I don't know where you're
sitting. I still go with, I have a lot of problems with the last half hour. Mm-hmm. I don't think it works very well. Hmm. I want to say theater because I'm just aghast by these reactions that just are angry at the movie because it wants to approach the subject matter in the way that it does.
Yeah.
But realistically, I'm going to say it's a strong rental.
Yeah.
The movie, as much as I appreciate what they're doing mm-hmm. and what they're attempting and the daring behind it, I don't think it's still strong enough to go to the theater to watch. But the kids are fantastic.
Yeah. And I guess my point to the folks who are poo-pooing it for the fact that you can't handle this sort of subject material, you know, in this voice or this tone, I always have to remind those people that, look, and I see this every day working in the news industry, I am dealt with gallows humor on a daily basis because of the fact that the subject material that I see on a daily basis mm-hmm. is so horrific and so terrible every day. The only way that a lot of us in the industry can make it by is by, like I say, gallows humor or some sort of humor as a release valve to be able to deal with this subject material. And if you can't laugh at sometimes some of this, even how horrific as it is, you will go insane. You will break down as a person and yeah. you'll hate yourself. So we got to have that release that valve in there somehow. So well, that's where I come in on that.
And I think if you find a way to do it, having 13, 14, 15-year-olds mm-hmm. be, you know, experience mm-hmm. stories like this, that's not a bad thing.
And I can also hedge a bet that there's a lot of 13, 14, 15-year-olds who are already witnessing something like this film has in it
yeah.
in some regard with kids in their own school.
Yeah, exactly.
So, let's just, get that one out there in front as well. So
I agree.
There's a big film for kids, though, this weekend.
Speaking of kids.
This is the third installment of Cars.
Yep, Cars 3.
I have not seen Cars 1, 2, or 3 now.
Really? Okay. Well,
I haven't seen a single one.
Don't get me wrong. You're not really missing much. I mean, they're not Pixar's best work.
Yeah.
But I think they're good work. I think they're perfectly charming and entertaining and fun for what they are.
And Steve, I see you nodding over here. Are you up to speed on any of the Cars franchise at all?
Yes, the first two.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
In that respect, I think the voice acting and the characterizations in the first two are outstanding.
Great.
That's where I would start.
Totally agree.
I mean, and that makes the films for me.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing more beautiful. Well, there is something more beautiful, but there's nothing more beautiful, he says, to repeat himself, than beautiful line reads from talented professional actors who know how to take lines on the page and make them come alive. Hmm. The first two Cars movies, I think, are immensely entertaining. I've seen the first two, actually, with my young niece, and she enjoyed them as well. Immensely entertaining and very consistently so. But I know, Sarah, that you're particularly enamored of number three. What's better about it?
Well, particularly, I don't know if I would go with particularly enamored. I think it's better. I think it's the best of the three. It's just more mature. It's more confident in the story that it's telling. It doesn't feel like, as much as I actually enjoyed the second one, it doesn't feel like it suddenly has to become this big, loud spy movie that one did and make the supporting characters more interesting than our main character, Lightning McQueen. It goes back to basics. I mean, this movie is basically about what it is for an athlete as they get older. Hmm. And, when they're nearing retirement and they're seeing the younger generation now stealing their spotlight. And so this allows the movie to actually circle back to the original Cars. And if anything, Cars 3 is a huge homage to Paul Newman. They use some scenes from the first film, but they also use outtakes. So it's almost like we get a new Paul Newman performance at times in this movie. But then you also have Chris Cooper, who comes in as the vehicle that trained Doc Hudson, Paul Newman's character from the first film. And there's also another fantastic new character named Cruz Ramirez, who is this female, who's this young, bubbly female, stereotypical female trainer who's supposed to get Lightning McQueen ready for the new race and the new generation and take them on. And he flips the switch on her at some point and becomes her trainer and her mentor because she has a secret desire of her own bum, 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 that, you know, might get realized as we near the end of the movie. It's very simple stuff. It's a standard inspirational sports story, much like the first one was. Mm-hmm. It's G-rated, and it is engineered more so than almost any other Pixar series. It is engineered for younger children. Hmm. If adults just allow themselves to enjoy it, though, it's fun.
Hmm. And genres can be comfortable, after all.
Yeah. No,
the,
I agree.
The thing that always impresses me about Pixar is their character development in all of their films. And now, not having seen a single one of these, I am going to fathom a guess, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but they perform, and Warren Etheridge kind of describes this in one of his workshops that I actually had a chance to attend, and he points this out, and I go, wow, that's really insightful on his part, but also of Pixar's part, that of all the characters, they do what's sort of a theory of mind. So you have a character who is faced with a decision, you know, A and B, right? And there are pros and cons of mm-hmm. both of them, but really what it comes down to is a transcendence of A and B to option C. Yeah. And that is the story of every Pixar film. And that's actually the story of almost every successful sure. film that we know. Is that what's going on
here
totally as well?
That's totally this. That is this movie in a T. Okay. But I mean, I don't want to ruin how it ends.
Sure.
But yes, that is this movie.
Yeah. And there's some nugget that they are working on the whole time. What is their nugget?
You
know,
of course.
And I don't need to know what the nugget is.
Hey, I just told you about the relationship between sure. Lightning McQueen and his new trainer. You can put the pieces together probably pretty quickly as to what's going to happen in the big race at the end of the movie.
Sure, sure.
And especially when you relate it back to the first one where, you know, Paul Newman's Doc Hudson comes out of retirement to be Lightning McQueen's crew chief. Uh-huh. Again, this is not rocket science to figure out what's going to happen here.
Where do you come in on this?
A quandary.
It's good.
Is it worth the $14 to take?
I mean, that's the problem. It's like, it's as spectacularly animated as any Pixar movie. It sounds and looks and feels incredible. Little kids are going to have to see this movie in a theater. They are going to love it to death. Yeah. It's hard for me to tell you to spend $15, $20 to go see a movie that's charming.
Okay.
But isn't...
Well, if it's not a yes, it's a no.
But so, I will go with a slight theater. I'll go with a theater. Yeah, I'm just going to go with a theater. Say theater. I liked it. What can I say? I liked it. It was charming.
Sure. Very good. Good enough. We'll work with that.
That's okay.
That being said, we all had a chance to see some films involved with Sif. Steve, we already talked about the fact you've seen 111. Sarah, you're somewhere in the 30, 40 range.
Yeah, like 30, 35.
I am skewing much, 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 much lower than all of you.
This was not a year where I actually was able to dig in. I did a lot of interviews, though. I did probably like 15 interviews, though, this year.
Right. What are some of the things that you guys are looking forward to either seeing on the retour, you know, because there's the Best of Sif that's going to be starting up here. What are some of the highlights that you noticed that really stand out to you? Steve, I'll toss it to you. What do you...
Well, I would cite a number of new American films with major directors and writers and stars in them that mm-hmm. are very challenging, very much adult films, and much quieter than much of what we've discussed already on this edition of The Squabble. Let's start with David Lowery's latest.
Yeah.
He reunites his stars from Ain't Those Body Saints, namely mm-hmm. Casey Affleck, the newly minted Best Actor Oscar winner, and Rooney Mara, in A Ghost Story. This is a contemplative film. In fact, when it screened at SIFF, he actually advised us before the screening, feel free to nap for a while if it enhances the experience, but please, just awake by the end and for the Q&A that we're going to do at the end of the film. It's a contemplation of grief and loss and legacy, in which one of the major characters literally appears through much of the film with a sheet over his head.
Yeah.
But that, too, is very complicated and very calculated.
Sure.
It's a story about a relationship disrupted by death and how one person who is still among the living and one person who views the aftermath, the legacy, the effects from some other state, suspended state, reflect upon legacy and how everything we do and every moment we live and every relationship we have has some kind of resonance into the future, even after we depart. It's very intelligently done. It's soft. It's quiet. It has relatively little dialogue. How radical is this for a movie with two major stars at the top of the cast? The biggest speech, the closest we come to any kind of speech or extended dialogue, is from an otherwise unnamed character at a party halfway through the film who talks about legacy amidst all the drinking and partying for about 4 or 5 minutes, far more dialogue than any of the major characters get. They do it with facial expressions, with body language, with the beauty and the simplicity of David Lowery's writing and cinematography and editing. He's a well-known editor, has edited this film as well. Let me tease you one last time.
Sure.
This is the movie this year when it comes out, and it will, of course, with that kind of talent behind it.
July.
This is a movie that has a pie-eating scene.
That's what I hear. There's, this
done,
is,
in, done in one take that lasts nearly 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And it really divided audiences at SIFF. For me, it's the single most important and meaningful scene in the film. I could have lived with 5 minutes, but the fact that it runs 10 is fine with me.
Yeah. I think Brian, the movie guy, had to get up and use the restroom. It was either Brian or maybe it was Drew.
No, it was Dave Chen.
Or was it Dave?
It was Dave Chen from Slash Film.
Got up, went to use bathroom, came back. Pie eating scene was still going on. Yeah. Okay. And there was a look of perplexed, I guess, bewilderment on the face. But
and he loved the movie. He talked about it on his show like right away. I mean, he loved the film, and still that was
So, okay, Ghost
Love
Story.
That movie.
Yeah, Ghost
Love
Story
that
being
movie.
One of those. Okay, that strong film. Sarah, what was one that jumped out at you?
I have a bunch that jumped out at me, but there are two coming in the next couple weeks. Uh-huh. Zoe Lister-Jones' Band-Aid, which I freaking love. And I didn't know I loved it when I first watched it.
Yeah.
And then I watched it a couple more times. I was preparing for an interview with her and I watched it again just to be prepared. And I found myself watching it a third time immediately.
Yeah.
It reminds me in so many ways of something like Once. Mm-hmm. It's so subtly intelligent with how it dissects relationships between men and women, especially when they're having issues in those relationships.
And the concept in this film is one of its real strengths.
Oh, totally.
Because it's the nature of relationships, especially the downtimes, the awkward moments, the angry moments that inform the songs. Mm-hmm. Produced and sung by the band.
Yes. Yeah, all of them. So a husband and wife, they create a band where instead of arguing in the kitchen like they normally have, they put all their arguments into music. And so their songs are all of their arguments.
Oh, it's kind of like the blues.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Sure.
But I love that movie. I just can't get it out of my head now. But also, and I can always pronounce his name wrong every single time. I'm going to do it again here. Hirokazuwa Koreeda.
Wow.
Is it close, Steve?
That's fairly close.
All right. His new movie, After the Storm, which opens in Seattle next week. Oh, my. I don't even want to really tell you too much about it. It's just a drama about a family kind of reconnecting with one another during a tsunami.
Mm-hmm.
Or a storm.
A typhoon.
Typhoon,
to be precise.
Thank you.
Typhoon, to be precise. Yes.
So there's a typhoon going on, and they just... It's so honest and so true and so beautiful and so delicate and just
and
magic.
And it features one of my favorite characters in all of SIFF this year, the grandmother.
Yes.
Is so wise and so humane and, laugh out loud funny much of the time. She is a great matriarch to this extended Japanese family. In many ways, she glues the film together, but I agree entirely with Sarah. It's a beautifully realized piece of work. There's really not a wasted scene in it.
Yeah.
And it's just beautifully constructed. Again, it's an adult story because it's intelligent. It involves adults. It involves real life situations to which we can all relate. Mm-hmm. And it plays out against the background, backdrop of a major sort of event.
Yeah.
Kieran Kiki, who is the grandmother, she's also in Koreeda's Still Walking. And if there was any justice, you know, we always talk about this every year, but if there was any justice in the world of the Academy Awards, this is an Oscar nominatable performance.
Yeah.
I mean, Oscar voters should be required to watch this film just to see Kiki work as this grandmother.
Very cool. I had a chance to catch one. I didn't even really realize it was a part of SIFF, but it was. And it apparently got notable. I think it got like a second place notification or something. I, Daniel Blake. Did either of you catch up with I, Daniel Blake?
I reviewed I, Daniel Blake back in December.
Right.
It barely missed my top 10 for last year.
That film, to me, was an eloquent heartbreak the entire film. The story of this working man. He's a carpenter slash handyman in not London, but England. He's
Northeastern England.
And he's out of work because of a heart attack. But then it becomes his wrestle with the state to continue to receive employment or continue to receive benefit while he is out of work. And then his wrestle through the medical system and the decider will make a choice on whether or not you receive any benefits here and this and that. And then he becomes involved with a young woman and her son. And just you're watching him and his core, this core of this incredibly good-hearted man being worked by the system and just absolutely a gem to watch, stem to stern.
When we voted in last year's Seattle Film Critics Society, David Johns was he plays Daniel Blank. He was my number two pick on my ballot.
Yeah.
As far as best actor was concerned.
Yeah.
Phenomenal. The other thing here, Ken Loach, he was 80 years old when he made this movie.
Right.
Hasn't lost an ounce.
Yes, yeah. I was going to point out credit to Ken Loach. I'm not certain I know of a more unabashedly political director. This not only has struck a nerve in the UK, it will here too.
Yeah.
When it gets wider release because of its timeliness. This is a man who consistently makes films about real, honest, working class people and the implacable system.
Right.
Or systems they have to face. And he pulls no punches in the story. David Johns got one of my votes for Best Actor at SIFF. Yeah. It's an extraordinarily powerful and, again, beautifully acted and very carefully crafted film by Ken Loach. It's meant to be in your face, and it works successfully.
Yeah. The irony, too, was the night that I was seeing it, the theater was almost empty, and I felt really bad. It also occurred to me that most folks were overseeing Angelica Houston.
Yeah, so there you go.
There was a reason they weren't there, but at the same time, I was like, why aren't people flocking to this film?
I have a partial answer, Adam, not to put you on the spot.
Yeah.
I passed on that particular screening that you must have attended.
Yeah.
That was a preview screening outside of SIFF, held in the context of SIFF after SIFF had already shown it twice.
Yes. So, yeah, there is that factor to it. Steve, another one that maybe is kind of still rattling around in your skull?
Well, there are a couple more. Believe me, there are dozens. Let's talk about Columbus, named not for Columbus, Ohio, but for Columbus, Indiana, which is home to some extraordinary modern architecture, courtesy of some of the most famous architects of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And it's a story set there by Konogata, who many of our listeners may know as an extraordinary, very talented video artist who often constructs and deconstructs various filmmakers and their work, starting with Ozu, who is clearly a strong influence here. It's a wonderful cast. Haley Lou Richardson from Edge of 17 and Split, the most recent film from M. Night Shyamalan. John Cho from Harold and Kumar and Star Trek and elsewhere. Michelle Forbes, Parker Posey, always a welcome presence, and Kieran Culkin. They are the core five. And basically, it's another fairly contemplative film, but it's about relationships and about space, finding space in your own life, finding space to express your emotions, but doing so while considering, gazing upon, evaluating, and walking through all of these amazing structures in this small town in Indiana, where John Cho's character has come to basically sit by the bedside of his estranged father, who's come over from the old country to lecture, only to suffer a heart attack.
Oh, no. Yeah.
It's a wonderful film, extremely intelligent, engaging performances. It's also neatly constructed in terms of relationships. Parker Posey's professor is the best friend to John Cho. Meanwhile, Kieran Culkin is the best friend to librarian Richardson, who is kind of the architectural nerd who was so interested in hearing John Cho's father speak. So it's about turning these buildings, which seem so modern, so avant-garde, so severe at first, into a kind of welcoming space for these characters as they open up, release their emotions, relate to each other. It's wonderfully well done. Highly recommended. And one more quick, much more energetic film, Gook.
Gook. Ah, Gook, yes.
Courtesy of Justin Chan, the director, co-writer, and star, set in the Paramount District of South L.A., adjacent to Compton, at the time of the riots associated with the Rodney King verdict 25 years ago. It's about racial strife and struggle and interaction, Koreans, African-Americans, and Latinos. It's about two Korean brothers who run their father's shoe store, and the legacy as that unfolds, befriended by a young African-American girl whose older brother blames the two Korean brothers' father for killing their mother. I mean, it's a very dense but relatable plot. You can follow it. The characters are very well drawn. A lot of laugh-out-loud humor and a lot of really very serious, searing drama along the way. Exceedingly well directed by Justin Chan. He keeps the storylines clear and straightforward, but he maintains the pace throughout. It's really well shot in a kind of, I guess you would say, quasi-sepia tone in a way. But he puts it in this historical context. I mean, there's a lot of comparisons here with Clerks, at least in passing, with Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. Some of the same elements, but kind of recombined, using 1992 as the setting, but making it contemporary for us now, 25 years later. It's very energetic. We get a little bit of a music video set piece in the middle of it. But as I say, there's a lot of warmth, a lot of humanity, but a lot of serious, straightforward, racially charged drama in the film, and he handles the tone pretty well from start to finish.
Yeah. Sarah, how about one more from you?
Oh, I think I just want to keep listening to Steve. I'm good right now.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it at that then. And we'll call it episode number 59. In quick review, Cars 3 getting a theater recommendation from Sarah. Kind of pulling teeth on that, though. Book of Henry getting two rentals. And The Mummy getting a rental and a skip out of us. And lots more recommendations again.
Oh, and just a reminder, Adam actually said The Dark Knight Rises is the best of the three movies. I'm just going to throw that out there.
And that is the second one, correct? if I'm not mistaken.
No, that's the third one.
Oh, no, the third one was that? No, that was a pile. No, the second one is the Dark Knight, right? So
You had me really worried there.
We're talking Heath Ledger, Joker, that.
All right, never mind, everybody. We're back on track.
We're back on track. No, three.
Until next week.
we'll have to reconsider all of that. So... my apologies. I've always had those confused. So you working on anything else at this point, Sarah?
Actually, I have an interview with Colin Trevorrow that I just did today, and it's going to be up on the site tomorrow. I also interviewed David Soren when he was here for the Seattle Film Festival for Captain Underpants. That's going to be up a little bit later tonight.
Mm. And Steve, anything brewing in the hopper for you?
Not necessarily, other than SIF withdrawal, as I go through every year, and just sort of bracing myself for the next onslaught of mega blockbuster franchise films. We've got Transformers, we've got Planet of the Apes, we've got a lot coming. So now I'm sort of changing my perspective from SIF mode, sort of flipping the glasses there, and preparing for more commercial but promising fare ahead.
How funny is it that we have both Transformers and War of the Planet of the Apes next week, and Transformers opens the next day, and War of the Planet of the Apes doesn't open for like a month?
I think it's indicative of many things. We shall see, shall we? All right. Episode 59, Cinema Squabble. Thanks much for joining us. Again, you can find us at cinemasquabble.com. You probably already have, or iTunes, or Stitcher. For Sarah Michelle Fitters and Steve Reeder, Adam Gerke, and thanks much to Sprint's Arbogast, our producer.